Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, I'm Rob Greaves and welcome to part two of my story. In this program, I reflect on how going from high school to Swinburne Tech, I decide I want to become an astronomer, but was pushed by the school counsellor into industrial chemistry, eventually working as an industrial chemist. However, on hearing the very first single by the Beatles, my life changed, and I look at how I formed my first band in 1964, and I also reflect on the wonderful experiences of that time with the growth of music and music venues in and around Melbourne. By 1967, I was being tugged strongly and inevitably into the alternate lifestyle that was developing in and around the inner suburb of Prahran. Oh, incidentally, I quit my job as an industrial chemist. I share some stories of my year as the editor of Scrag, the Swinburne student newspaper, and then my story moves into what might loosely be called my hippie years, and my life in and around the then notorious Greville Street in Prahran, and how this tied into the anti-Vietnam War movement, and how, although I was conscripted, I didn't end up in the army. Yet my face became splattered across the newspaper The Australian as a result of my participation in the Melbourne anti-Vietnam demonstration in June of 1971. We pick up now with me talking about 1962 and why it was I moved from high school to Swinburne Tech. By the time 1962 had come around, in fact, by the time 1961 had finished, it was quite obvious that my time at Waverley High School probably should be coming to an end. And I believe the high school actually suggested to my mother that I leave and find a trade job. Now, fortunately, my parents thought higher and better of me. Not that there's anything wrong with trade work, but they, having come from a working class background, really wanted to see their son become a, inverted commas, a professional. But what they did was to talk to me, and we decided that what I would do would be to aim to go to Swinburne Institute of Technology, as it was known then. It's now Swinburne University of Technology. But before I could do that, I had to enrol in the Swinburne Junior School and basically go back, or basically enter at year five level, do year five and six, and then sort of get into the senior school. The problem for me was that they were doing subjects that I'd never heard of, let alone could grasp. The two that come to mind were technical drawing, and the other one was solid geometry. Now, for all the kids in the class, they'd been doing this for 2 or 3 years prior to year five, and I came in at year five, and I was just absolutely hopeless. Fortunately, my father, as I said, being a toolmaker, was very skilled at both reading and drawing, technical drawings, in order to make die casts, which was part of his job. So he helped me, but look, I really struggled with it. I never quite grasped it. And by the time I got to year 12, we were interviewed in terms of what we saw our future as being. And I wanted to be an astronomer. I really was interested in astronomy and thought that that would be a fascinating job. Well, they just couldn't understand it. They just couldn't grasp that somebody would want to be an astronomer. So they enrolled me in the School of Chemistry. And I was going to become a chemist, an industrial chemist. So I, when the correct time came, I went across to the senior school and joined the chemistry department. And I have to say, in terms of the practical side of the chemistry course, which was in those days a diploma of applied chemistry, I was fantastic. I was brilliant. I just shot through all the practical work like you wouldn't believe. In fact, I got about 2 years ahead. Because you could work at your own pace, and if you passed, you just moved into the next level. But in the theory, I struggled. In organic chemistry, I was okay at, but I just never could quite cope with organic chemistry, carbon-based chemistry. It also found that it was very strange. It was almost as if they didn't really have enough subjects to make it interesting, and they filled it up with things like glass blowing, which I found fascinating. You were being taught how to make your own glass chemical apparatus, which was fantastic. But I think even in those days, there were very few chemists that actually had to make their own equipment. And the other one we had to do was Scientific German, where they made it very clear you weren't going to be taught to be able to speak German and even read conventional German, but be able to translate German chemical textbooks. Well, that was fascinating. Not. And again, I just to this day think it was a fill, you know, to make sure they filled the subjects with enough hours that you eventually would get your diploma. I actually started work as a trainee chemist in a number of places, including, ironically, going back to Yarraville, which was the place where my parents first moved to, and to a place called Albright and Wilson, who were phosphate manufacturers. And there are many stories there I could and I might get into, but something bigger was happening. And I remember very clearly in 1962, standing at the railway station at Glenferrie, waiting to catch a train home, and somebody had a transistor radio on at the platform, and I heard this piece of music, which now is very basic, but just grabbed me. And it was a track called Love Me Do by the Beatles. And I stopped and I listened transfixed. In fact, I missed my train to make sure I heard the whole track. And that just fired something in my imagination. Up until that time, I'd started to develop an interest in music. I particularly found myself drawn to West Coast American surf music, groups like Dick Dale and the Deltones as an example. I just found the sound of that electric guitar was something really different, and it really grabbed me. But now, this was real music. And my life changed at that time. It really did. It wasn't long after I was wandering around Jordanville where I was living, and I came across this local hall, and I could hear music being played, and I stuck my head in, and it was four guys, an instrumental band, and they were playing Shadows tracks and things like that. And all it did was make me go, I want to do this, but I don't want to play Shadows music. I want to play Beatles. I want to play Rolling Stones. But I didn't know how to go about it. So, with the money I was making from doing odd jobs and, you know, delivering newspapers and things, I very stupidly, without any insight, went out and bought my first electric guitar, which I now know was not much better than a thick, heavy plank of wood that had been polished with guitar strings on it. And I couldn't work out in those days why I could not get my fingers down onto the frets, because the strings were so far above them. I almost had to clamp them down there. And I remember how hard it was. My fingers used to bleed. And to this day, on my left hand, my four fingers, other than my thumb, basically have no fingerprints on them, because they were just chopped up so badly and scarred that as the years went on, those scars sort of smoothed out, but the fingerprints never came back on. But I wanted to play guitar. So the next thing I did was put an advert in the newspaper to see if there's anybody in the local newspaper, to see if there were any other kids interested. And that's how I met a person who I'm still friends with to today, Mick Elliott. Now, Mick was talented. Mick was just a natural guitar player. And I didn't realise it, but even then he was light years ahead of me and would always be light years ahead in terms of guitar work. And Mick went on to play in some really, really top groups. You know, he was in Sailor, he was in the Wild Beaver Band, Stars. He was in a backing group that backed Bo Diddley and a whole range of other overseas artists. And to this day, Mick is held in great esteem in the music industry for his talent. Mick introduced me to his friend, who was a guitarist but was happy to play bass, and that was Mark Barnes, who some listeners would know. Mark went on to go into bigger and better things, both in Campact and to become a promoter. A little bit more about that later on. But between us and finding a drummer, we started rehearsing. Our first group was called the Sonics, which was not very original, and I think Mick said that many times. That then eventually became the sound, which was not much better. Before we started developing ourselves and our love and understanding of music, and we became the Mopper Blues. My introduction to the blues largely came about because at that stage we were also meeting other young bands, and there was one called Roadrunners, who eventually became the Delta Set, and a young English guitarist, Chris Stockley, who is now also, like Mick, quite revered in the Australian music industry. And Chris went on to some fantastic bands, such as the Dingoes, Axiom, Campact, Southern Cross, and Stockley, C and Mason, just to name a few. So Chris was another very talented musician, but what he did, he brought with him, because he'd only just arrived in Australia, 63, 64, a wealth of knowledge in terms of what was not just happening in Europe, but in terms of the American blues scene. And he introduced all of us to the wonders of Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf and John Lee Hooker and Sonny Boy Williamson, one and two, and just so many artists, which really opened up not only our ears, but opened us up to that style of music. And so the Mopper Blues were born, and the Mopper Blues played blues. Like all the young bands, we played some really crappy, small local halls, but we also then started to play in some of the big town halls, and of course some of the big venues, some of the discos around town. It was an exciting period. Australian music really had its birth in that 64-65 year period. And so I also was introduced to a lot of other people in the industry, like David Dr. Pepper Pepperell. And it was a close-knit society, in fact. You know, everybody was really quite friendly. Everybody sort of helped everybody else out, whilst also maintaining a little bit of professional distance with one band against the other. But look, it was fantastic. Eventually, Mark Barnes left the Mopper Blues, and John Sullivan, who would go on to join the Rondells, Bobby and Laurie's backing group, joined us, both playing bass and singing. And the Mopper Blues was probably at its highest point at that stage. And my passion was great. I love music, but my guitar playing really didn't match that level of ability that I had. Oh, it was poor. My passion was great, my ability was poor. I can't put it any other way. And eventually I was actually kicked out of my own band to be replaced by Rick Springfield. So I guess if you're going to be replaced by somebody, it might as well be somebody who went on to bigger and better things. And of course, it wasn't that much longer before the Mopper Blues broke up and Rick Springfield went on to a very successful solo career.
Listen to older voices. Living history on Ageless Radio.
I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm sharing with you my recollections of being a young man in the 1960s. Music was so incredibly important, but by 1967, so was the alternate lifestyle that was developing in and around Melbourne. And you could say, I guess I embraced that hippie philosophy and lifestyle, and so it was I moved into Greville Street, Paran. I moved into a place called Dobie's Bakery, which was an old bakery, on the left-hand side of Greville Street as you went down towards the railway station, only about a dozen or so shops up from the station hotel, and shared that place with Mark Barnes and John Boyce, who also went on to become the bass player for the Dingoes. And life was, again, a ball. It just seemed to be that no matter which direction you took, life was just wonderful. Now, mind you, Greville Street in those days, in the very, very early 70s, in fact, probably 1970, was a bit of a pit. It certainly wasn't its upmarket, updated version that you find today. Very few of the shops were actually open. They were all run down. You could rent one for next to nothing. And of course, as long as you didn't mind leaking roofs and rats and things like that, it was cheap digs. And that's where the alternate society, it really did develop in and around Greville Street. I guess in some ways that alternate lifestyle was in two major areas, St Kilda, which really was more drug focused, and Greville Street, which was more just truly alternate focus. It didn't mean to say drugs weren't around. Most of us smoked like chimneys in those days. And sadly, eventually those heavy drugs did come into Greville Street, and that was the end of it all when that happened. But down the road was the Station Hotel. And for a while it was our hangout just to have a beer and that. But eventually it became one of Melbourne's not just notorious, but best places for live music. Mark Barnes had a lot to do with that and promoted it very heavily. And quite frankly, it got to the point where if you didn't play at the Station Hotel, then really you hadn't made it. And everybody who was anybody played at the Station Hotel. Eventually, across the road from the Station Hotel, the guys from Captain Matchbox Band moved in. Feedwell Foundry opened up, and gradually the place started sort of looking more like a hive of activity rather than just a place where you could find cheap digs to live. And leather shops opened, and the place started to buzz. Mark also got the gig as the art director of the Swinburne Institute's newspaper, Scrag. And he offered the job to Dave Pepperell to edit it, but Dave was busy on other things. So he offered me the job, and so I took over editing the Swinburne newspaper with Mark as art director. And that lasted 12 months before we made so many enemies in the engineering school that we had to get out of town, basically. In those days, Swinburne was divided into two main groups. There were the engineers and there were the arts people. And you were in one group or the other. And for a while, the arts people ran Swinburne before the engineers then took it over. So for that 12 months that I was working at Scrag, Mark and I had carte blanche of what we did. And he and I really did turn it into Scrag, into an alternate newspaper rather than just a standard college tertiary institute newspaper. But things were happening all over the place, which sort of supported that. You know, we had the Vietnam War demonstrations. Certainly, there was an incredible groundswell against the Australian involvement in Vietnam. And it was probably a turning point in many regards, politically and certainly socially, for how Australians viewed themselves and their place. At that stage, there's the very famous saying by an Australian Prime Minister of all the way with LBJ, and that's how we were. Whatever the Americans wanted, we did lockstep. When it came to Vietnam, though, we took a different turn. It wasn't just the young who were out in the streets. It was everybody, professionals, tradespeople, older people, younger people, alternates. Everybody was out there all with the same thing, to stop the war and get Australians out of Vietnam. We had a wonderful thing called conscription then, and your birth date would be put on a marble and put in a big barrel, and it was rolled around, and then randomly marbles would be pulled out. And if your number came out, then you were conscripted. And my number came out. It certainly did. I was so against the Vietnam War. Fortunately, I never had to get to the point where I had to choose what I was going to do if I actually went into the army. And to this day, I'm not quite sure what I wanted to do. I really did not want to go in the army. I was just so opposed to violence. I was so opposed to the Vietnam War. There's no way this young hippie wanted to go out and fight. But I turned up for my medical. And prior to that, I remember having a paper bag full of pollens and dust and things, because I did suffer from asthma, and I remember sucking on it madly to try and bring on an asthma attack before the medical. But of course, my heart was pumping at a million beats per minute with the unknown, and of course my adrenaline was flying. So by the time I got in there for the medical, my adrenaline had kicked out any semblance of an asthma attack, and I thought, oh boy, I'm in for it now. Fortunately, what I didn't realise was that the medical people did do a background check with your family doctor, and I did have a history of asthma, and my doctor did verify that. And I remember to this day getting a letter saying along the lines of, dear sir, we regret to advise you that you do not meet the current medical standards for the army. And I got out.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition. I should say that prior to that, I actually avoided the draft or going in for the medical for a couple of years because I was considered to be working in a protected industry. I did mention earlier that I was working as an industrial chemist, and so that was considered as a protected industry. But around about 1968, 69, I left chemistry. I remember walking into the laboratory one day and the sun was pouring through the window, and I just stood there and I had an epiphany, and it was, what the hell am I doing in this place when there's so much else going on outside that I really want to do? And that's when I basically changed my lifestyle and threw away the conservatism of the 30s and 40s and 50s that we had inherited through all our parents, and like a lot of young people in those days, decided, no, that's not for me. I want to find my own way, and I want to do it in terms of what's going on around me. It's not like there was a concerted or a focused effort to change society. It just happened, you know, whether it was fashions, whether it was music, whether it was arts, whether it was, you know, positions for or against wars, things were changing. And a lot of young people just refused to be shackled by the old concepts of the previous generations. I do have to point out that it wasn't a major movement, certainly not in Melbourne. There was certainly a movement in Melbourne in terms of an alternate lifestyle, but it wasn't like it was, say, in San Francisco or even Los Angeles in the States, where it was, you know, it was a popular movement. It was still focused mainly around St Kilda, Prahran, and Coburg, Brunswick to a degree, but there were still a lot of boomers, for instance, that didn't join the cause. But I deviate there. So I remember that the day of the Great Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War march in Melbourne in 1971, I certainly went, and I was there, and quite surprised when a couple of days later I opened up a newspaper and there was my picture on the front page with a clenched fist, headband, screaming at a police car. Do you know, I don't actually remember doing it, but hey, I can't deny it. There's the picture. Also tied up with the anti-Vietnam War movement and that period of working as the editor of Scrag, I remember getting, I didn't get a call because Mark and I were living together in Greville Street, and he woke me up one morning saying, hey, listen, grab your motorcycle. And again, a little deviation here. At that stage, I was riding a Triumph 650cc motorcycle, one of my great delights. He said, somebody's painted peace on the shrine. So he grabbed his camera, jumped on the back of the motorcycle, and we rode off to the shrine. And do you know, we got there and there was nobody there. There were no guards, there were no police, just peace painted on the pillars of the shrine. Now, I probably don't need to say this, but I'm going to say it. We had absolutely nothing to do with writing that on the shrine. But Mark, being the art director, could see a cover for the forthcoming Scrag. And so he got me on the motorcycle coming down the steps in front of the shrine with one hand in a peace sign, one hand in a clenched fist. And we had the cover of Scrag, which read, "Is there no fear in the fraternity of the doomed?" A fantastic cover. And to this day, a very unknown picture, but one I think that really summed up what was going on around us in those days. Of course, now in retrospect, I really do see that as highly inappropriate, and not just painting peace on the shrine, but what we did. And on one hand, I don't regret taking that picture or having that picture taken, because it really did represent a moment in time and space in Melbourne. But on the other hand, I've grown to appreciate a whole different perspective on the shrine and what it stands for. And yeah, I certainly wouldn't condone that today, even though, as I said, I have no regrets of doing it then. By 1972, I was in great danger of becoming poisoned. My liver was becoming poisoned through alcohol. Everyone around me, particularly in the music scene, were either smoking like chimneys and drinking copious quantities of alcohol. And I knew that if I kept hanging out in that scene, I might die, to put it frankly. And as it turned out, a few other people at that time, they didn't die then, but they certainly did die subsequently from the indulgences of those days. I failed to mention meeting a man who would become a lifelong friend of mine called David. I was driving down Dandenong Road across Chapel Street one day, and there was this long-haired guy hitchhiking. So I pulled up and stopped and asked him where he was going, and he told me he was heading towards South Yarra where he had a house. And so I gave him a lift and we got talking, and that moment, I didn't know it then, would turn into an incredible set of adventures throughout the rest of my life. I dropped him off and I didn't see him again for a couple of months, and then I went to a party one day or one evening and David was there, and so we reconnected and suddenly realised that we actually had a lot in common. Although, as I learnt later on, the fact that I was an industrial chemist caught his ear because he had a friend called Charles. And Charles was the son of an English aristocrat who had escaped what he saw as the shackles of the aristocracy in England and came to Australia. And Charles was quite interested in the fact that I was a chemist and could I be of use to helping him make some psychedelic drugs. Well, whether or not that actually happened, you're going to have to wait for the next program to find out. But it certainly kicked off yet another series of amazing adventures for me. Life was not dull. In next week's program, we visit my years as a youth officer in Winlaton Youth Training Centre for Girls, of meeting my lifetime friend David, and how we formed a musical partnership that lasted some 40 years. This and much more on Listen to Older Voices next week. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.